This week's episode is sponsored by Amico & Co, the full-service refit shipyard at the heart of the Med, with large yacht facilities, in-house departments, and berthing in its waterfront marina. To find out more, visit amicoshipyard.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of Boat Briefing. My name is Stuart Campbell and here to help me navigate through all the news from the world of superyachting is Charlotte Hogarth-Jones. Hi Charlotte.
Hi Stu, how are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad.
Good to see you back in the UK.
Yeah, back in the UK, but we're recording remotely. And we were laughing earlier, weren't we, about some of the podcast situations we got ourselves in during the pandemic. Recording in cupboards and the like.
Yeah, it's so strange. I mean, we did a lot of strange things during the pandemic and we weren't the first podcast to pop up in that period, but I'm glad that we've survived. You know, we weren't one of those flash in the pan podcasts. We've gone the distance, we've come out of the other side.
Yeah, we have.
Now in upgraded facilities, other than my wardrobe.
Yeah, we're out of the cupboard.
Yeah.
Into the living room. Yeah, it's nice to be back in the country. I've spent last week and the weekend over in Spain, kicked off my Spanish sojourn in Palma. So I was over in Mallorca for the Superyacht Charities golf event, my first time there, but I was really quite impressed. It was loads of people, very well supported, very well organised, and they raised a lot of money. So it was fantastic. Hacked my way around a very nice golf course.
Very nice. Are you a good golfer?
I'm an average golfer, like 1 in 10 shots, like classic someone who doesn't play very often. You know, I'll play one nice shot in 10 and think, got this game sussed, this is easy, and then duff the next one or just slice it into trees and then get very, very cross. That's how I play golf.
Take chunks out.
Exactly. But it's great because they play this Texas scramble format. So for those of you who don't play a lot of golf, it's kind of best ball. So if you're playing in a team and two or four of you tee off and three go awry and one's okay, you just play from the best ball, basically. So
right, okay. So you got to hope you're paired up with decent people then, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. But it kind of all averages out. And over the course of 18 holes, you know, occasionally your shot will be the best ball. So you feel like you're contributing something to the team. but it was, yeah, lots of money raised for lots of great causes. And it's quite clever how they do it because the beers are free flowing throughout the day. So, and there's opportunities at most of the holes to contribute to charity. So the more you drink, the looser your wallet becomes. So you just end up tapping these card machines all over the course.
It's all kind of pretend money.
Yeah, you slightly feel that way. But it's the best way to guarantee a decent raise from the players. I loved it. So congrats to everyone involved in putting that together. I thought it was a really, really fun event and everyone seemed very, very happy at the end of the day, mainly because, you know, most of them were drunk about 26
10 wines beers. In. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Well, I mean, it sounds like that was all in a good cause. But you're there for the cup as well, right?
Yeah, so after the golf, I zoomed over to Barcelona at the crack of dawn. To check out the America's Cup. I missed the last one, obviously, because it was in Auckland in 2021 and it was during the pandemic, so no one could get there. But I was over in Bermuda in 2017 for the America's Cup there, and I loved it. And we ran the Superyacht Regatta there and were quite involved in that event. So I was very, very excited to get to Barcelona. So I spent one day on a very lovely sailing yacht called Q out watching the racing, and it was great being out on a boat on the water, but you do almost envy those watching on TV because the TV experience of watching the America's Cup is actually a lot better.
You can actually see up close what's going on. I mean, how far, you know, were you kind of looking at things through binoculars or were you close enough that you could pretty much see what was going on, just not as well as on the screens?
It's hard to get the context from the water level of what exactly is going on. And the TV graphics now are so good for the America's Cup that it's... So the best scenario that we had a big TV in the aft cockpit, so we kind of had the TV on and we could refer to what was happening on the water there and then. But the course kind of drifts according to the wind conditions. So 1 minute you're kind of right up against the boundary marker for the course, and the next minute it's drifted a bit, so you're away. But you know, it, taking nothing away from it, it was a really fun day.
But a shame the result wasn't better.
Yeah, the result.
What did we say?
Yeah, so we're 4-0 down as of this recording, and two races later today, and it is very much all going Emirates Team New Zealand's way.
Yeah, if you were to place a bet, would you say we're out of the running?
Well, they're firm favourites. You get some pretty long odds betting on Ben and Ineos at the moment. But you never know. Look, he has a track record of pulling victories out of the bag against all the odds, as he did in 2013 in San Francisco. So I never count Ben Ainslie out.
Yeah.
He is a champion, and for good reason.
So I asked ChatGPT if they could begin. ChatGPT has become my version of like the magic eight ball. All questions that I'm not sure the answer to, I think, well, let's ask AI, let's ask the computer. And it responded to, can UK win the America's Cup? It's definitely possible for Britain to clinch the trophy. The competition is fierce, but anything can happen in sailing. So we shall see.
That is a wishy-washy answer from
I know, it's very non-committal, isn't it? We'll see.
It's become one of my principal search engines, ChatGPT. It is actually bloody useful for finding out information in a hurry that would take you otherwise kind of 10 minutes to Google and dig around various websites. ChatGPT is very, very effective at finding out bits and pieces.
Yeah, definitely. And just being able to narrow that search by putting in exact parameters of, you know, only from these websites or whatever.
Yeah.
But we had our owners event in Barcelona as well, right?
Yeah, that's right. We did a really spectacular dinner for owners and some friends at the Maritime Museum in Barcelona. And it was just the most spectacular venue for a dinner like that. And we had a great turnout. It was fantastic. And Shirley Robertson, whose voice will be very familiar to everyone watching the America's Cup, because she's one of the lead commentators. And she came that evening and gave a bit of context to what was going on and some of the tech involved and mood in the camps and all that kind of stuff. And obviously Shirley, a very excellent sailor herself with two Olympic gold medals. So she was the perfect person to come along and talk to everyone there about the cup. So that was great.
What did she say about moods in the camp then? I'm interested, what was her kind of reports?
Well, we were only 2-0 down at that stage. So she, her messaging was, there's a long way to go. And similarly, never count Ben out. Like, the Ineos team is teched up to the eyeballs, and they've had a lot of input from Mercedes, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Some very, very bright minds, working with that team. So, fingers crossed we can pull back a few races today and make it a bit more of a competition for everyone watching.
Yeah.
But I mean, Barcelona, it was cool. There was lots of branding for the cup about the place, and obviously everyone was aware of it. I don't know, maybe I wasn't there long enough. I didn't quite feel like the city had really kind of had the cup fever.
Well, there were the protests, weren't there?
Yeah, there were some protests there. There was one when I was there on Saturday morning. I was walking around the docks, and we went out on a little chase boat just to follow Ineos and Emirates Team New Zealand out of the harbour. But whilst we were there, there was this protest against the cup. And later that day, actually, I was walking around Barcelona, and people had stuck stickers up on pylons and any flat surface they could find, really, basically saying, I think it was something like, love the water, hate the cup. So it's a shame, really. Because, it's a great sporting event. It's generated a lot of wealth for Barcelona, and it's brought in lots of people from other parts of the world experiencing the city, maybe for the first time, lots of boats in town, spending money with local businesses and hotel rooms and restaurants and all that associated spending you get with a big sporting event like this. And yet it felt like there was definitely a section of the Barcelona population that wasn't a massive fan or believer in the reasons for the cup being there, which I thought was a great shame.
Yeah, I mean, that's so key, isn't it? Because when I think back to the London Olympics, one of the really special things about it is that everyone, you know, people that had tickets, people that didn't, there was a real kind of buzz around the whole capital of people wanting to be part of it, wanting to be involved, wanting to engage with it. But it is difficult to gauge the protest from the media, which is why I was interested in your point of view, because you read different reports. You know, the first thing I read said 2,000 protesters, something else said 6,000 protests. You know, it's hard to ascertain from this distance whether it was kind of a sort of disgruntled small group of locals or whether actually there was quite a significant chunk of the population. But from what you're saying, it sounds like the mood was that there was some kind of tension there.
Yeah, it felt that way. It felt that way. And but you know, everyone who was there for the right for the cup reasons were super excited. Like, the owners that we engaged with, it just felt any big sporting event like that, I always get really excited about it. And I definitely, for the people who loved it, were loving it.
Yeah.
There was a few other protests that were on in town, not America's Cup related, but about various other things going on in the world. And it made getting around a little tricky, actually. So on the Friday night? The Friday night we had our dinner, Saturday night, sorry. So I was out on the boat on Saturday during the day, but then getting back into the port on Saturday was quite tricky because there's this massive traffic jam of boats getting into Marina Vella where Q was berthed.
Right.
So we got back quite late and then no taxi would pick me up. And I was under strict instructions from our events team to be at the venue just after 6 with the dinner starting at 7. We got off the boat at about 5:15. No taxi would pick me up and it would take too long.
And taxis wouldn't pick you up because of the congestion and they just didn't want to get it swept up into it, or they couldn't get in there?
They couldn't, because of the protests.
Yeah.
So then I had to rent one of those kind of renter bikes for the first time ever in my life. So I was trying to navigate around Barcelona, trying to look at my phone, figure out where I was going, dodge all the pedestrians and not get hit by a bus.
You were going to say you had gone for one of those sort of comedy tuk-tuks or something.
No. it was quite comedic watching this kind of harried, stressed, late, lanky Englishman trying to not kill a pedestrian get back to the hotel in Barcelona. And then I was told off by a policeman because I was trying to, you know, lock the bike up against the lamppost. And he screamed at me in Spanish, and my Spanish is average, so it was all a bit stressful, but I managed to get to the dinner just in time.
Well, it sounds like there are enough people there to give you a glass of wine and carry on with a good evening afterwards.
Yeah, it was a great night. So we'll see what happens today really with races 5 and 6. Come on Ben,
how are you actually watching it? Because there are YouTube. Various different platforms. YouTube, right?
Yeah, YouTube.
Okay, so that's the one to watch.
With all the graphical overlays, you learn pretty quickly. But then it seems like, legs 4-5, where New Zealand have really been stretching their lead so far in the Cup. So a lot of people were talking about Ineos favouring lumpier, windier conditions. And I think that's forecast for today. So we'll see what happens today. But I just hope they... the deficit is closed quick enough for the Cup to be extended beyond the weekend, because this could all be over by the weekend if it all keeps going Emirates Team New Zealand's way.
God, it's really like hand in mouth type stuff, this. I find it so exciting because, you know, it's such a historic event and the chance to be kind of, you know, even at this stage is so exciting. But yeah, it's, fingers crossed for everyone. And if you're waiting for your YouTube ads to load and you're listening to this, if you're kind of in between races, it's worth having a read. We interviewed Toto Wolff, obviously, from the Mercedes team, ran in our October issue, but that's online now. And he had some interesting things to say just about the kind of the tech of the boat and what it was like being on board, particularly that he was saying even at 40 knots on foils, it still feels incredibly stable and it doesn't feel scary. I'm not sure whether his idea of scary and mine are the same. I'm pretty sure I would find that kind of a bit terrifying. But he then went on to talk about how he would design his perfect super yacht, and it's an interesting read.
Yeah, it's a great story. We should point out that it was written by Georgie Ainslie. That's Ben Ainslie's wife, and you know, she's incredibly well known in her own right. TV presenter, commentator, panel show participant. But yeah, have a read of that one because it's online now. And Toto's a fascinating guy. Likes to go free diving with Lewis Hamilton.
Yeah, apparently they had to stop them free diving together because they were both pushing themselves so hard. I think they were kind of worried what might happen next. But yeah, he lives in Monaco and he talks about kind of free diving around the boats there and various wrecks he visits. And it's kind of fascinating topic, actually.
Free diving is just a terrifying.
Well, he describes it as you reach this kind of moment of calm where your kind of pulse drops and you're floating in the water. It sounded rather peaceful, but I've never done it. I suspect I wouldn't even get beyond 2 meters or something before having to come back up for air.
No, I have a panic attack if I have to hold my breath for more than 10 seconds underwater, so I'm not sure I'd make a very good free diver.
Yeah.
But this is the first time you've been on the podcast since Monaco. So
I know. It feels like it's been forever, actually. But yes, it is.
And I mean, it was your first Monaco Yacht Show as the new co-chair of the Boat Design and Innovation Award. So I was just interested to see, or hear rather, your perspective as you know, when now you were involved in that program and seeing lots and lots of boats, what your kind of standouts were.
Yeah, well, I mean, firstly, it was so much fun. Like, it was a bit like being on a kind of school trip with a group of naughty school children in between the very serious business of actually being on the boats and judging, kind of running around the entire of Monaco Yacht Show and hopping in and out of tenders in pouring rain and choppy waters was much more fun than you might think. But what I absolutely loved about it was a real kind of learning experience for me, because all of these judges are real specialists in their own kind of niche and their own expertise. And what I noticed going around the boats, and, you know, I spent some time with these guys in Cannes as well, it's all of them have their own little bugbears, little quirks, little tests that they like to carry out. I thought I'd read a few of them out here, because I know that sometimes people listening to this podcast are working on boats at the moment. So if you are in the middle of, for example, building a vanity table, so this is a big one, a couple of the judges have this bugbear that when you sit down at those beautifully designed vanity tables in the main salon and there's a kind of fold-out mirror, very often the level you're sitting at, you can't actually see yourself in the fold-out mirror. It's all done to kind of fold in and be very sleek and discreet. But actually, if you were sitting at those things, trying to put your makeup on, not that you probably do, Stu, but if someone was trying to do something like that, they wouldn't actually be able to see their own face. So there are surprising things like that, that you're like, God, that's actually such bad design. Or, you know, doors where you have, another common one was where you have a passageway into the kind of private master cabin or something, and maybe a head just as you come in, doors clashing, you know, not having that little few millimeters of design so that you can open both at the same time. Another one that came up was kind of staircases. That's something that gets scrutinized a lot, both how they feel as you're going down them. Are there any kind of weird voids that are left? Is there anything interesting done with that space? Is it actually a nice design feature to have some empty space circulating around a staircase? Very often, sometimes the stairs would just kind of end, or, you know, the finishes and the textures and everything wouldn't kind of flow into the design as you reach the end of the staircase, which is quite interesting. And another thing that came up time and time again was, you know, we're moving away from all these kind of exotic animal skins and things, which I think is great. But there seems to be a world of difference between a good fake, you know, fake such and such and a bad one. So, for example, real shagreen has these kind of, you wouldn't notice them if you didn't know, but these kind of distinctive circles meant to mimic the pattern on the animal's body. A really good fake shagreen has that same kind of irregularity on it. So there was a lot of attention on that kind of thing. So say it's not the real deal, how close is it? Does it have the details that mean you wouldn't be able to tell? So it was really interesting seeing what everyone's kind of pet hates and bugbears was. And I learned a bit more about what my own were, in terms of there are certain things like I realized I absolutely hate. And I think I've always realized this, but it's not until you've been on like 30 boats in 2 weeks that it really smacks you around the head. I hate when you come onto the kind of opening lounge And quite often you'll find two kind of backless sofas pointing in random directions. I hate that, because whoever sits on a backless sofa, right, you don't flop into it and watch a movie, you don't hang out with your mates. It's completely, I think, completely useless item of furniture and useless waste of the space. And some really cool boats weren't even using their lounges like that. They were, you know, getting rid of that seating area altogether and making it a bar or a library space or something much more usable. So I think how designs are keeping in step with how we're evolving as clientele is quite interesting. So hate the backless sofas, hate crap crew quarters. I just feel like there's maybe no excuse for that anymore, especially when you're looking at these enormous boats that still have these horrible areas in the bowels of the boat that they're never very keen for you to see. I very much follow this, you know, happy crew, happy boat type mentality. And I think if you're building a beautiful boat from scratch, why not give your crew somewhere that they can be really proud of and happy to be there? Also, I really love a kind of good nook with a view. We saw quite a few of those this year, kind of little windows with little chaise longue type furniture pieces on them, or just little corners where you can gaze out at the sea and have a sort of private reading a book or something like that. And also I love a boat that feels really solid, which sounds ridiculous to say because all of these are made to amazing standards, but you can definitely feel that difference when you're walking on certain boats, when you're feeling things that some of them just feel, you know, absolutely solid as a rock. You can feel the quality, and some of them feel a bit more plasticky, even if they're actually using kind of great materials. I think you can always sort of sense a bit when there have been corners cut somewhere along the line. But what are yours? I wonder, you know, you've been on so many boats by now. Are there things that always get you?
It's just the backless sofa thing. It feels a bit corporate, doesn't it? You're right. You don't know whether to sit or lie on it.
It's so awkward to sit on a backward sofa. Yeah. What do? You sit up straight like you're kind of on a pole, or you try and do some kind of weird lean. It's weird. It's weird.
Yeah. I'm totally with you on the crap crew quarters one. I remember being on one boat and the owner had opted to supplement his already very generous master cabin with this kind of anteroom, which had pushed the galley below decks, which had really, really compromised the lower deck crew quarters. And I remember walking down there and thinking, crew are going to turn over so fast on this boat because this is just not good enough for a boat of this size. Too much stainless steel, fingerprints, you know, everywhere. I just feel you walk up. I saw on some boats I avoid putting my hand on the stainless steel handrails. It's because, yeah. I think, you know, it just after too many, you just think the crew are constantly wiping them up and down, getting the greasy fingerprints off them. Carpets that mark easily, too many glossy surfaces, not a great fan. Some boats, you know, that kind of space as you enter the main saloon, some designers opt to put a big dining table there, often a big circular one, which makes getting round it a bit awkward to get to the main saloon. Galleys without windows, no handholds. So I've got a sofa one, actually. Often sofas are too deep. So if you're trying to conduct a conversation, you feel uncomfortably relaxed when you're trying to talk to someone on it because you're both kind of in this.
You get a bit kind of eaten by the sofa.
Yeah, you get kind of, you do. It's completely eaten by the sofa. And it just feels a bit, if you're trying to talk, hold a conversation, it just feels a bit awkward.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
The buttons, overcomplicated buttons on doors that, you know, they often take forever to open. And you press it and nothing happens, and you think you know it's not working. You press it again, but then it starts opening. It's lots of stuff like that. Really, I imagine, you know, over the course of your life on the boat might get quite grating after a while.
It's funny you mentioned the stainless steel, because one of the designers was telling me there was a boat recently that had these kind of very impressive glass balustrades all the way around on all of the decks. And they ended up taking them down a year after the boat had been in service, because it was taking one crew member, you know, it was a full-time job just endlessly polishing glass. And there are so many things that look great, you know, look great in a photo, but actually, like you say, are they that practical to maintain? And on the tech point, there was something that made me laugh as well. On one of the boats, they were kind of explaining that guests get given almost like a Fitbit type bracelet to wear that tells them, and I don't know how common these are, it's the first I'd heard of them, tells them where the guests are at any one time so they can prepare, right? So if they know a guest's in the gym, they can, you know, have the bottle of water ready in the next room or whatever. But it just made me laugh. So I was thinking, if I was sort of permanently stationed in the bar or the hot tub or something, they might just think it wasn't working. But yeah, there were some interesting designs as well that stood out. One was that I love this kind of return to, on land, they call it dopamine design, this kind of idea of designing for happiness and designing for fun. But I really noticed that in both these shows. And it was really notable that all the boats that people were talking about had that real element of playfulness and almost a kind of childlike, you know, kids toy box type feel about them. Yeah. So, you know, Casper 7 was the big one in that. It just reminded me like of a huge Polly Pocket, like a sort of 90s toy. It was all in pastel colors and lots of things that you wanted to pick up and play with and touch. It all kind of very tactile.
I had to Google Polly Pocket in preparation.
Did you? 90s baby hit. For those not in the know, Polly Pocket was like a small plastic toy made in all these 90s kind of bubblegum pink and lilac and mint green kind of, you would only know. So, okay, Polly Pocket, maybe not the most universal reference, but it was like a kid's toy, basically, but a kind of very fun, cute kid's toy. And lots of kind of tactile things. On the wall, they had a lot of 3D decor, like little tiny vases with tiny flowers in or kind of corals and things like that. There was an Anish Kapoor art installation that projected a rainbow onto a sheet of metal, which was just amazing. So much to kind of engage with and play with. Even the handrail, as you slid your hand down the handrail, the width of the banister varied. So it kind of felt quite fun sliding your hand down the handrail. It felt like you were sort of sliding down the stairs like a little kid. So that was great. But also, if you looked on board Maverick, you know, a super yacht that got a lot of attention, they had this big swing that everyone was sitting on and playing on, a big bath that opened out on the deck so you could have a kind of open air bath looking out at the sea. On Kismet, they had this kind of light up engine room, a bit like something from Tron, where you could walk through this neon engine room. And even that reminded me of, you know, when you're a little kid, I don't think they do it anymore, but you used to be able to ask to go and see the captain on the plane you were at. It reminded me of that, you know, as a guest on this beautiful boat, you might be able to say, oh, can I see the engine? And someone would take you down. And it really taps into the amazingness of what these crazy machines are and how they work, and, you know, making that a fun, cool experience that guests can kind of have an in on, I think is great. Another thing that we saw a lot of is that lots of these boats, and I think we're going to do a piece on this at some point in the near future, had a bit more of an emphasis on self-service. So, for example, if you went onto the Salon of Casper, you wouldn't find a big backless sofa. You'd find a kind of snack bar full of Haribo and fancy biscuits and wine that she was joking, you know, me and my husband and my friends, when we come back from a dinner on board, we all end up sitting around this table and stuffing our faces with sweets and having a few extra drinks. But lots of them actually had these kind of central bars in the salon for post-dinner drinks and chilling out. And, you know, I think increasingly owners just want to be able to pass a beer to their mates without calling someone in to do it for them. And they have the facility to do that if they want to have a fancier dinner, if they want to entertain corporate guests. But if they just want to have a good time with their friends, they can all help themselves. And I think that's really nice, and it's a really interesting new trend. It was also a great opportunity for me to spot there are quite a few things that make kind of brilliant entries to our backer awards. Which, if you're not listening, this is our kind of fairly recently launched, it's in its second year now, awards, which is celebrating artisanship and craft on super yachts. And so many boats had, you know, incredible things like beautiful straw marquetry or an incredible staircase with really beautiful carved woodwork on it. And that's the kind of thing that these awards are really to recognise, kind of individual works, be they work of art or items of furniture, you know, lighting, anything like that, but things that are real kind of amazing examples of craftsmanship from either an individual or a team. So it was great to see a few of those, and I know that the nominations for this year have now closed, so I'm looking forward to seeing who ends up winning, which will be announced in Kitzbühel in January.
Yeah, I love these awards. They're a great opportunity to surface some of that incredible talent that you don't often get to hear about. That is, you know, some of these guys are commissioned by design studios and spend, you know, thousands of man hours sometimes crafting a unique item for a yacht. And yeah, it's just a way of celebrating that fantastic achievement. So yeah, second year, it's going well. And yeah, we'll have a new set of winners in February.
Yeah, definitely.
Meanwhile, Charlotte, I heard you had an interesting catch-up recently with Nikos Pateras.
I did, yeah. Not at Monaco, actually, earlier in the year, but I'm kind of working on that article now. And he's a fascinating owner. So he's owned 8 super yachts.
Just the eight.
All pretty big. Currently he owns Adamas 5, which was built for the Emir of Qatar originally. And he has a sailboat too called Wally B. But he's a name that might ring a few bells with people. He's the former owner of, firstly, a family business called Pateras Bros, which his granddad started. But then he founded Pacific and Atlantic, obviously a huge shipping company. And he did very, very well, actually, during COVID, when those shipping companies were just keeping the world alive, basically. Now he's the owner of a container ships business called Cont Ships, which he said was very hard to break into originally. But what I love talking to him, you know, hearing his experiences as an owner, having grown up in shipping and, you know, yachting runs in his blood, but particularly this kind of, you know, commercial shipping. So he's telling me little stories of his dad used to take him to the office as a kid. And before all this software and tracking, they used to have big magnetic maps of where all the ships were in the world. So he used to be allowed to like go and look, oh, we have a ship in India, and imagine what it would be like to be in India. And he did things like he once drove John Bannenberg around when he was just 14, obviously having no idea who he was. But it was interesting hearing his point of reference, because he was saying, you know, his experience in the shipping industry and actually having worked on boats, he worked in his teens. His dad sent him off to actually work on these container ships. You know, his perspective as an owner is based a lot around safety. So lots of the design features and things that I think are cool, he thinks are a disaster, because he thinks, well, the cushions could fly off, or someone could fly off that, or, you know. And he was saying he never does a night crossing without being on the bridge personally himself, even if he has all his staff on watch. So it made me wonder, you know, in terms of designing a boat, is it better to come to it knowing nothing about boats at all, being a brand new owner with money in your pocket and having some crazy ideas, or is it better to come to it with some experience of what can go wrong? Will those beautiful glass panels be a real pain to maintain? All that kind of thing. The jury's out from my side, but what do you think?
Oh, God, that's a big question. I think if you're a shipyard, you want the experienced owner, because an experienced design team, because working with newcomers can be quite challenging, and managing their expectations around a particular project. So I think I'd err on the side of experience rather than inexperience when it comes to that question.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Nikos Pateras. So when are we going to be able to read about him in the magazine?
That will be in our January issue, I think. In December, there's a really cool Aussie owner who we've profiled. Interesting stuff going on in that part of the world. I mentioned earlier in the year, we've got our piece all about the Australian super yacht market online now. And yeah, he's the Australian owner. He owns a boat called Big Sky. It sounds like it would be great fun cruising with him. His stories are amazing. So definitely look out for that one as well.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to reading about Mr. Pateras. All right, we better get on with some brokerage picks. So I've chosen a boat that was around Monaco during the show, and there was a bit of chat about it because I think it was quite busy with potential clients visiting, and that is, of course, 65-meter Fedship Wedge 2. So I've shamelessly stolen this idea from Nick Jeffrey, who was our brokerage editor, who used this as his brokerage pick of the week online. So thank you, Nick.
Are you going to be sharing it with Nick? If you could both buy it, would you?
Absolutely, yeah. I've ripped a lot of this information straight out of Nick's article. So thank you, Nick, for putting that together. So the brokers involved in selling Wedge 2 are Camper Nicholson's and the newly formed Fedship Resale. So if you haven't heard about this new initiative from Fedship, it's been set up, in their words, to help protect the interests of Fedship yacht owners. They went on to say FedShip Resale is not intended to replace the brokerage industry, but to complement it. So FedShip Resale is working with Camper Nicholson's on this particular sale. So Wedge 2, very famous yacht, and for sale for the very first time. She was delivered in 2002 and was designed by superstar, what do they call them? Starkitect. designer Philip Stark. So he did the exterior and interior. And she's known Wedge 2. Frequent visitors to Monaco will know this boat well because she's often there, berth stern too. And she's got kind of these wood sections in her superstructure that are very distinctive. Alex Lees Buckley is the broker from CNN. C&N. It was involved in the sale, and he said there's only one word to describe Wedge 2, and it's iconic. Meanwhile, Philip Stark himself told us, "I set out to make a boat of extraordinary quality while trying to cleanse it of these overwhelming social and financial representations. We worked for almost 3 years and it's wonderful and charming owners and with a highly competent shipyard. And in 1999, Wedge 2 was finally launched. The challenge had been met. It is still a yacht, a fabulously expensive one, but with the excuse that these people live on it all year round. It is their home. I saw this boat coming out of the shipyard, profoundly elegant. It certainly wasn't oppressive. It was a home and not a pile of gold." Classic words there from Stark. He's all about, he makes similar points about the various other boats he's worked on, like Motor Yacht A and Sailing Yacht A. I remember I met him in Abu Dhabi when I'd interviewed him on board Motor Yacht A, actually. And it's all about dematerialization and all that. So he uses words like that. And I think he certainly struck that theme with Wedge 2. So Nick Jeffrey put together an interesting price comparison with other yachts of equivalent size on the market currently. So Wedge 2 is asking 49.5 million euros. In the same rough size range, there is 63-meter Rossi Navi Utopia 4 from 2018. She's asking $45.9 million. 70-meter Jade Verft built Amadeus, delivered in 2007, is asking €48.5 million. And Queen Mavia, the 62-meter Ocean Cove, delivered in 2001, is asking €34.9 million. So a few options if you're in the market for a 65-meter well-built boat at the moment. And if you're after Wedge 2, she's asking around €38,000 per gross ton. So for a very well-known FedShip and a classic FedShip at that, with lots of space and Stark's brand, I think she could be a great buy.
I'm not surprised you went for that. I know that you love Philippe Stark, so it's got your name all over it.
Yeah. So what was your pick?
My pick, maybe a bit rogue, but my pick is the Abking and Rasmussen Amaryllis, which is 78.43 metres, built in 2011, top speed of 16 knots, beam of 12.4 metres, gross tonnage 2,108, and can accommodate 12 guests and 23 crew. And two reasons for picking this. One, I absolutely just love the exterior lines of it. It's a really kind of sleek, sharp, elegant, slimline kind of exterior, which I think is beautiful. But also I was just thinking about, you know, Kismet at Monaco Yacht Show, obviously all the attention, huge queues of people trying to talk their way on board. But actually there are a few similarities. This is almost like a kind of, you know, mini former Kismet in that it had an amazing interior done by Raymond Langton, obviously the team behind the interior on Kismet. And I can definitely see some similarities in it as well. And I love it's got some really good sized stately grand cabins. It's got three ensuite doubles and a twin cabin on the lower deck, and then a VIP suite on the main deck. And the master stateroom has a private owner's deck with his and hers bathrooms and an office and a dressing room and these big kind of 180 degree panoramic windows that you can look out from, with a private deck and a sunbathing space. But yeah, the interior, that it's got that kind of grandeur about it, which is quite interesting. It's got some custom made furniture by Silver Lining. We really love their stuff. It's got a glass elevator and a big spiral staircase, which unites the lower deck with the bridge deck. Then some, you know, not hugely surprising, but it's got a sun deck with a big jacuzzi and a beach club on the lower deck as well, with a gym, super high-tech gym, a spa with a sauna, a steam room, a plunge pool, a massage suite. Apparently she had her hull repainted back in 2022 and a refit, although I'm not quite sure what went on during the refit. I know that I think she was sanctioned at one point, Amaryllis. But she is now for sale. And apparently when the stabilizers are on, when she's underway, it's super kind of, yeah, super stable. You wouldn't know she was moving through the water. And I haven't told you how much she is for sale, which is maybe a key sticking point here. But I remember it was just great. 2 seconds.
I'll ask ChatGPT.
I'll ask ChatGPT. She is for sale for 89 million euros, which I think, yeah, why not? It's a very nice boat.
Amaryllis is a very nice boat. So 89 million euro Amaryllis, or 65 meter Fedship Wedge 2. That's the brokerage war this week.
I think mine will go first. You know, I know that this is a bet every week, but I will be closely tracking this one because I am sure Amaryllis will be snapped up soon.
We shall see. Alrighty, let's whip through some headlines, and we'll start with the news at 85.9 meter Benetti Superyacht Kingdom 5KR. Rather shockingly, it crashed into a quay in Tunisia last week. Imagery shows the extent of the damage to Kingdom 5KR's bow and the quay itself following the collision. I mean, it really crunched into this dock. It was quite shocking to see.
I mean, the pics of it are really like, oh my God, it's all kind of, you can really, quite often with these crashes, you don't really clearly see the damage. You just then get some images of the yachts in the water. But with this, you can see up close the big crunch, and it's not good.
Yeah, the boat came off worse out of that encounter, I think. The dock, sure. Concrete dock definitely took a bite out of the bow. But a very famous boat, as everyone will know, Kingdom 5KR was originally built as Nabila and commissioned by Saudi billionaire Adnan Khashoggi. And she's had some very high-profile owners in the decades since, including none other than former President Donald Trump, who renamed her Trump Princess and took her into Manhattan, I think, on one of his first voyages on board. Now in Saudi ownership again. And it was also featured in a Bond movie, Never Say Never Again. Mm-hmm. So the area around the boat has been cordoned off by authorities down there in Tunisia, and an investigation is underway into exactly what happened.
I'll wait to find out. Next up is the news that Netherlands-based builder Holtermann Shipyard has reportedly been declared bankrupt and is being investigated for takeover by potential investors. Curator Rink de Vries confirmed to local news publications that the yard has been operating at a loss since 2022, fueled by a lack of new orders and rising aluminium prices. Holtermann was initially founded in 1964 by Johannes Holtermann, who passed the company to his son Robert Holtermann in 1993. Robert would later expand the yard's offering to include yachts up to 33 metres in length under the brand Extreme Yachts, including previous Boat Design and Innovation Award winner and World Superyacht Award nominee Lady Fleur. Remember that boat? It's a beautiful boat.
Yeah, it was well received. Well, I hope a buyer comes along because they've got some really interesting designs, Holtermann. We'll see what happens there and keep you updated via the boat business channel. Last up is the news that Italian shipyard Codacasta has delivered. This is a nightmare of vowels, this word. It's spelled G-I-O-I-A. So I'm going to go with Gioia. Okay, let's go. Gioia. Italian shipyard Codacasta has delivered Gioia, the sixth unit in its Codacasta 43 series. According to Boat Pro, the 43 metre has departed from the yard's facilities in Via Reggio and is now anchored in Saint-Tropez. Work on the 43-metre project began on spec in April 2022, with the owner joining the build during an advanced stage of construction. The superyacht's most recent sister ship is Bodgy, which hit the water in 2022. So Joya has an internal volume just below 500 gross tonnes, a 9-metre beam and 2.6-metre draft. The yacht's equipped with two CAT engines, and she should hit speeds of 16 knots with a range of 4,000 nautical miles at a cruising speed of 11 knots. Congrats to Cody Casa, yep, and the new owner of Joya. And that just leaves us with the data section. We're going to focus on FLIBS this week. And as ever, our data is brought to you by Boat Pro, the superyacht industry's leading market intelligence service. So Raphael, our data guru down the south of France, has been digging behind the scenes of FLIBS. And we reckon there will be 159 yachts over 24 metres in attendance, which is a bit above average, because we were on average is around 150 yachts every year over 24 metres. So great that we're above average for 2024. Those 159 superyachts have an average LOA of 37 metres. Some of the boats making their world or US debuts at FLIBS include King Benji, the 46.7-metre long motor yacht from Dunia, delivered this year. We've got an Oceano 44 from Over Marine Group will be there. Ocean Alexander 35P, Moonen 110 Mustique, Ocean Alexander 28L, a Pearl 82 and a Viking 82 will all be making their US or world debuts.
I want to talk about the largest yachts at FLIBS, because look who's there at number one. I didn't even plan this. Amaryllis. So if you did want to buy it and you were going to FLIBS, there she is. What a great boat. So there we go. Largest yachts at FLIBS. Amaryllis in at number one.
So if she's bought at FLIBS, you will be winning this week's brokerage pick.
Exactly. I feel like I should win some actual prize for this, because I'm that confident based on very little, but I still think it will happen. Anyway, Amaryllis will be there. Also, Casino Royale, Amadeus, Lune, Marguerite, Moonstone, Bella Vita, Unbridled, Skyfall, Fedship W, and Starship by Delta Marine.
So plenty of big stuff, which is great.
Yeah.
And 159 superyachts in total. Obviously, FLIBS is vast, massive, expanding show. So it's a good one. I enjoy it. I enjoy it. And we've got a nice air-conditioned booth. So swing by for a coffee or a beer during one of the various happy hours and come say hi. It'll be great to see you.
Amazing. Looks like a great show.
Yeah. Fingers crossed. And that's it for this week. Episode of Boat Briefing, which was mixed and produced by the wonderful team of Adam Geist and Naomi Wilson. Actually, having said that, it won't be mixed and produced by Naomi Wilson, because she's no longer Naomi Wilson after recently getting married in Portugal. So huge congrats to Naomi. I hope you have a wonderful honeymoon. Meanwhile, don't forget to like and subscribe. And we will see you next time.